Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/C101. That's lynda.com/C101. And by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. On this wildcard episode of Coding 101, we're speaking with Noah Addy. Hello and welcome to Coding 101. It's the Twitch show where we let you into the world of the Code Monkey slash Code Warrior. I'm Father Robert Ballaser, the Digital Jesuit. And joining me, as always, is Lou Maresca, our super special King Kamehameha co-host. Lou, how are you over in the Great Northwest?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. You know, I'd be doing better, though, if my camera wouldn't freeze on me.
Yeah, well, you know, we can get that sorted. But this is a coding show. It's not a hardware fixing show, so we'll have to put that off. But I am very excited because we have with us today for this super special wildcard episode. And remember, the wildcard episodes are the ones that we do in between the programming modules to sort of cleanse the palate, let you switch from one language to the next by speaking to the people who actually do what you want to learn in real life. And we've brought in a ringer, Mr. Noah Addy. He is the co-founder of and the CEO of Digital Fio. Noah, thank you very much for being on Coding 101.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
For the folks at home, could you tell us really quickly, what is Digital Fio?
So Digital Fio is a startup that I started in Seattle. And for a long time, I'd always been in the corporate world, and especially coming from Africa, you know, I wasn't really very entrepreneurial. And so I think after I met a few people that really taught me a lot about business, I think I got to the point where I just really wanted to just start my own thing where I could just kind of bring my own dreams to life. And so that's really what led me to start Digital Fio. And one thing, I named it after my mom. My mom's name is Fio, F-I-O. So I named my company after my mom, Mafio.
Nice. And what is it that you do? So what's the principal product, the principal service of Digital?
And so I build like websites for different people. One of the latest projects that I did was actually for one of the biggest casinos in Washington State. I built like a customer reward system for them. So I do everything from UX design, web development, and sometimes I do some mobile work as well.
And how did you meet Lou Maresca? Because he was the one who brought you to our attention. He said, this would be a good man to have on Coding 101. So what links you to the great Lou?
This is crazy. I met Lou in Fargo, North Dakota. You heard that right. So I went from Ghana, West Africa, into Fargo, North Dakota. And I met Lou in class. And this guy was smart, you know. And I think, every time I meet really smart people, I get fascinated. And so I was really impressed with Lou. You know, he was just an incredibly smart guy. And I learned actually learned quite a bit from him. So we ended up, I think, doing a team project together where I was like, man, this guy is really good. I got to be friends with him. And, I lived in Fargo, North Dakota for about 10 years before I moved to Seattle. And Lou followed me to Seattle. He couldn't get enough of me.
That is weird that you meet in Fargo, which, by the way, I have been in Fargo. And I have to say, I was a high school student when I was there, and we did have an incredibly entertaining time riding ice cubes down the side of freeway. It was a thing. I don't know. You would get an ice block and you would ride it down on ramps, but go figure. But Lou, Fargo, North Dakota, what were the two of you doing there?
Yeah, so Microsoft had just acquired a company called Great Plains Software back in 2003. And, I was interviewing with different business software companies, and actually Microsoft was one of them. And I actually didn't know that I was going to be coming to Fargo, but I actually ended up moving to Fargo in 2004, And Manon and I met in grad school, actually. So I went to get my grad degree at NDSU, which is North Dakota State University. And both of us were doing computer science there. And so we just met in class one day.
I have to say, though, Noah sounded very surprised that you were so intelligent. So I'm not sure. did I get that right? That was a weird vibe.
No. I was just really fascinated. You know, I love smart people. So I was just really fascinated by him.
Right. Let's talk about you before Fargo, because you do have a very interesting background. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up? What yes. was your first exposure to computers and computer programming?
You know, this is interesting, and I get a little emotional when I think about this, because I actually grew up in a really, really poor family. And this was back in Ghana, West Africa, in a very small town called Takoradi. And, you know, I think that I really didn't have much of a chance at life. And kind of randomly, through a lot of kind of crazy situations, I got some help from one of my friend's dad to help me come to the U.S. And when I came to the U.S., I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But when I came to college, a lot of the people from Ghana were doing computer science. So I said, well, I'll do computer science too. And I'd never used a computer before. I think the most I'd done was like send a Yahoo email. But I got some help from somebody at the Internet Cafe. So I really didn't know how to use a computer. I came to the U.S. in 2001. And I think that was really my first exposure to computers. And it was really, really hard.
I know you said that a lot of people from Ghana are doing computer science. Is that actually a thing? Do people think about coming to the Western world, to the United States, and being computer scientists while still in Ghana?
You know, I think at the time when I left Ghana, this was back in 2001, the internet had just started taking off. And so there was a lot of buzz about the internet. You know, there was a lot of people starting internet cafes, you know, and I think because of the economy, it wasn't really like you could have your own computer at home. A lot of people didn't have the luxury. And so for some of us, the only opportunity to use a computer was to go to an internet cafe where you pay some money to use a computer. So when I came to Fargo, North Dakota, it was really the first time I had my own laptop, right? The first time I even learned about programming and things like that. So it was a really challenging journey.
So how did you learn your craft? Like, what languages did you learn up front, and how did you learn those languages?
You know, in school, I started with a C++ and some Java. But honestly, I think for me, just a lot of the really factors were I really had to focus on trying to pay for school. I was also an international student, right? And I wasn't an American citizen. And so I didn't really have the luxury of being able to do like internships and things like that. Because as an international student, you had to either pay for school or you get kicked out. And so for me, the programming and the computer stuff wasn't really a top priority. My biggest priority was to stay in the U.S. and stay in school, at least, you know, survive. Because just because of my background, just being in the U.S. really afforded me a lot of opportunity to help a lot of folks back home. And so even after school, when I had taken C++ classes, I really wasn't that good of a programmer. So I think it was after I graduated was when I really started struggling to find a job, when I essentially decided to go back and learn everything from scratch. And then that kind of got me into C#, because at the time .NET was kind of the hot new thing. So then that got me into C#, .NET, and eventually some HTML, some CSS, and some JavaScript.
Let's unpack that, because that little history is actually, that's incredible. Yeah. You start, and I don't want to get political. Let's not get political. Let's talk about story. You yeah. say, look, your primary concern was staying in the United States. That was your goal.
Yeah.
So did you choose computer science because you saw that as a way to achieve the goal? I mean, was it computer science is something that they need, computer science is something that they want, so if I learn computer science, I become needed, I become wanted, it increases my chances of staying here? Or was there something else that kept driving you into CS?
For me, computer science really was an accidental kind of thing. Because back in Ghana, what I really wanted to, well, initially I wanted to be a medical doctor. And then I realized I really hated biology. So back in Ghana, I think at the time when I was in high school, the most prestigious major was electrical engineering. So I actually ended up doing 1 year of electrical engineering at a university back in Ghana. So when I came to the States, I really wanted to do electrical engineering, but the college I went to didn't have the program. So I just said, well, I'll do computer science because a lot of the students from Ghana were doing computer science. So I'll just do that. I didn't really know what to expect out of it.
Right, right. Okay, I can see that. But you said you wanted to be a doctor until you realized you hated biology. You can't just say I'm going to be a computer scientist because everyone else is doing it or because I want to stay in the country.
Yes.
There must have been something at some point in that little development story that you gave us when you ended up with .NET. Somewhere along the line, was there a, okay, this, I like this, or I can relate to this, or by golly, I'm good at this. Because even you admit that at the beginning, you weren't a great coder. What turned you from that, from it's something I can do, to I'm going to start a company that does this?
You know, I think for me, really, coming to the U.S. By itself was one of just the best opportunities I've ever had in my life. And I think because of the unemployment situation and the economic situation back in Ghana, for us, for a lot of young people, anytime you can get to the U.S. by itself, even if I was working at McDonald's and not going to school, that right there will put me ahead of a lot of my peers back home. And so for me, just coming to the U.S. by itself was just huge. And so when I came here, it didn't really matter what program I got into. All I just really wanted to do was just be in the U.S. And I think that by itself just offered me just so much opportunity. And so when I started kind of doing computer science, I think the first actually class I took was like Word or Excel. And I was like, man, I actually kind of enjoy this. It's kind of fun. You know, but it was hard, man. I tell you, man, that my first year in the U.S. was my most challenging task I've ever been through. One, I couldn't type. And so it would take me about an hour to type like one page of a Word document. And I would always be the last person to leave the computer lab because I was up till like 3-4 in the morning trying to type a Word document, you know, and it was really challenging. And then the language, right? You know, I'm in North Dakota. I can barely understand anybody. I can barely understand my professors. Dude, it was really challenging.
Wow. We like to talk about how difficult it is for us to do our craft and how difficult it is for us to learn our craft. But I can't imagine trying to learn computer programming while you're still trying to learn English and while you're still trying to just keep up with basic studies. So let me ask you, going into this path and finding the initial start of your interest in CS,
mm-hmm.
I find it a great time to ask you a question that we ask of many of our visitors. And that is, mm-hmm. when you look at the people who can make it in CS, when you look at the people who can make it into a career, mm-hmm. do you see a pattern of desires, a pattern of interests that need to be there? We're fond of saying, look, anyone can code. If you give them enough time, you can memorize it. But to mm-hmm. be an actual programmer, to be someone who can convert real-world problems into questions that can be solved with code, it takes a very specific type of personality. Do you know what that might be?
You know, for me, I think the passion came later. I think initially it was just really just something for opportunity. But later I'll tell you a story about seven other people that I ended up training that all became computer science people when they had no IT background or they didn't even know they would like it. And so I think for me, really, it just became a matter of, okay, it's opportunity. There's a lot of job openings in the computer field. Let me just get in there. And then once I got in there and I was able to really kind of start to understand the basics and what I can make the computer do for me and make me really productive, I think that's when the passion really came in. I think the passion can get you really far. But personally, it was just a matter of opportunity and just really finding a job.
So let's get into your wheelhouse, so to speak. So what, maybe you could explain what UX design is and what do you do?
Mm-hmm. So, I picked up design after I'd done programming for a while. And this was because I met this manager that didn't have a designer on the team. And, you know, I just wanted to code and just, you know, that's really what I wanted to do. But he wanted the UI to look good. And I said, hey, you know, if you want the design to look good, you got to hire a designer. He says, sorry, Noah, we don't have a budget for designer, so you got to figure it out. So that really kind of forced me into getting into design. And I think over time, what I really have learned about design really is just know, I think the core basics is essentially just try to make something very simple for the user to use and something that also really delightful for the user to use.
I want to throw a question to both of you. I found this fun tension that you get between the programming team, the dev team, and the design team. And it's been this way every business I've ever visited, Zappos, Amazon, Google, where you get the computer programming team, the dev team, who they almost want people to see how complicated the solution is. I mean, they want people to see how much work they put into making this thing go. And then the design team comes and they said, take this out. And again, as you said, it's got to be simple enough for the user to not have to think about everything that goes in there. Do you get this tension? Lou, do you get this at Microsoft? And Noah, do you get this at your company?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest things at Microsoft is we'll give a designer a piece of software. And they'll say, hey, this is how we want it to implement it. And they basically tell us, well, you know, from past experience, we've done user groups and we've noticed that this won't work or this won't work. We want to make this easier. We need to add these buttons or this usability, this accessibility. And sometimes UX ends up getting changed completely. So, you know, as a developer programmer, sometimes I want some of the, what do you call it, the power user type interfaces with the fast keystrokes and the really easy entry, data entry, that kind of thing. But designers, they want, you know, ease of use, but they also want, you know, everything to look pretty and for the emotions of the users to be affected. So there's a lot of different, there's cardinality between the two, but there's also a lot of differences and it's sometimes hard.
Noah, what about you? Do you find that tension? Do you often find design teams that you work with pushing back against the choices that you make and your team makes?
Yeah. And I think, I think in the past few years, I think design is really starting to play a really big role in especially enterprise software, right? I think for the first time in many years, companies are really starting to actually pay attention to design, especially, you know, when it comes to even things they build for developers, you know, who, you know, some of whom really want to just use like the command line, you know. So I think that when you look at some of the conflict between kind of designers and developers, I think over time we're actually kind of coming together. We're actually kind of aligning on one common goal. This is, hey, let's build something that's easy to use, that's simple, and that's intuitive.
We've got Beef Love in the chat room who's saying, coders are right, designers are wrong. And that's a throwaway line. But the funny thing is, I hear that all the time. I hear the design team saying, these coders, they would love if everything was command line. And that's actually kind of true. And I hear the coders saying the design team has no idea what the users want. They're just trying to make it pretty. They add fluff. And it's a very strange intersection of disciplines that, as you said, Noah, I think enterprise is actually starting to pick that up.
Yep.
Let's be honest. The current push for design did come from Apple.
Yes.
They were the ones who came. I mean, right or wrong, like them or not, Apple came up with a lot of the cues that are being followed from consumer up to the enterprise level. Where
I agree.
We want to give you that simple design. We want to give you beautiful design. We want to give you a design that belittles the work that the dev team has put into making this. That's a strange place to be. Lou, do you get that a lot with your teams? You actually lead dev teams. Do your devs understand what needs to happen for good design?
So developers start to get used to doing that. I mean, they work with the developers and they work with the designers and they kind of get the gist of it, especially when you're developing an app especially for like iOS. I mean, when you're developing an app for iOS, you have to fit a specific design language for that platform. So you tend to start to get the gist of it and the usability of it. And you see sometimes the nice thing about apps and how people rate them is you also get insight into what people like to use and how they use it. So it also gives the developer a little bit more. So if you're just a single developer building your own software out there on your own startup, you can get the gist, you can get the idea of what design's working for people and how, you know, you can emulate and then improve on, right? So that's kind of the gist. And that's what most developers do.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Noah Addy, who is teaching us a little bit about design. What do you need to take the project that you've coded, the team that you've shepherded through the development stage, and create a interface that people will actually want to use? Noah, when we come back, I'm hoping that we can dive a bit more into the choices that you make in UX design. Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the first sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. We talk a lot about programming languages here on Coding 101. Of course, that's what we do. And when we're not in a wildcard episode, we're programming. We're showing you how to use PHP or Java or Ruby, whatever it may be. But we can only give you a very short glimpse into what it takes to program, what it takes to code. You need someplace that you can go to learn at your own pace, that you can learn the material, the languages that you want to learn right now in the way that you see best fit. Well, that's why we're happy to have lynda.com as a sponsor of Coding 101. Lynda.com is a repository for knowledge, not just for coding, but for pretty much everything, every self-improvement, every skills learning project, everything that you want to learn about every hobby, every skill, every job trait, you'll find at lynda.com. Lynda.com is for problem solvers. It's for the curious, for the people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to learn how to develop an app, or maybe you want to master a new programming language. Maybe you want to take better photos or sharpen your Excel skills. Lynda.com has everything you need to feed your curious mind. Right now, they've got courses including building and distributing a simple app with Xcode and Swift, C-sharp interfaces and generics, up and running with Google Apps Script, and up and running with Python and Django. Lynda.com has also added two new courses if you want to develop for wearables. This is a hot new area that you could get in on the ground floor. They'll teach you building apps for Android Wear devices and building a calculator for Apple Watch, which will take you through all the steps, and by the end of it, you will have developed your first app for the Apple Watch. With a Lynda.com membership, you can watch and learn from top experts who are passionate about teaching. You can stream thousands of video courses on demand that are high-quality audio and video. I mean, I don't want to disparage the courses that you'll find on YouTube. There's some great know-how people out there, great DIYers, great makers. But sometimes you don't want to have to worry about janky audio or shaky video. Sometimes you just want to concentrate on the content. And that's what Lynda.com will give you each and every time. They'll also let you learn at your own pace. The courses are structured so that you can watch them from start to finish or consume them in bite-sized pieces. And they even give you a transcript. So if you have a question, if you need a reference point, you can jump straight to the video, straight to the clip, straight to the second that will answer your question. You can take notes as you go, and you can refer to them later. And you can download the tutorials and watch them on the go on your iOS or Android devices. I also love the fact that you can create and save playlists and share them with your friends, because in this day and age of the maker, of the programmer, of the doer, of the curious, there's nothing quite like giving a playlist to a friend and saying, this is what I'm learning. I'd love for you to learn it too. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try Lynda.com. Your Lynda.com membership gives you unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics, all for one low flat rate. Whether you're looking to become an expert, you're passionate about a hobby, or you just want to learn something new, I want you to visit lynda.com/C101 and sign up for your free 10-day trial. That's lynda.com, lynda.com/C101. And we thank lynda.com for their support of Coding 101. Noah, we're talking about design, about responsive design. Could you let us know, how have you seen design change over the last 10 years?
Oh, man. I think design is has come a very long way. And I think a lot of people agree that this was really pioneered by Apple, right? I think Apple and the iPhone and mobile applications really started to push their limits, right? Where a lot of people now actually started picking up and say, wow, if you can actually build something and make it simple and make it intuitive to use, make it intuitive to use, people will buy the product. So I think a lot of people are really catching on that you're starting to see this in other, you know, hardware devices and even software. And now it's actually getting to enterprise software where people now actually starting to pay attention to design and say, hey, the fact that we're building something for developers, that doesn't mean we can just make it crappy, right? We can actually put effort into it and make it simple and intuitive and beautiful as well.
So what, in your experience, you've done a bunch of projects in the back end, you've done some corporate projects, and you've done big corporations and so on. What types of things in the UX kind of strike the nerves of users and get to the kind of the emotions of the user when they actually use it?
I think the top one is simplicity. You know, I think that just if you make it really simple for the user to use without really having to trying to force them to change the way they work, I think you get a lot of traction with that. Also, I think one of the really top things is just finding a way to really appeal to the user's emotions. I think Apple does a really good job with that, with some of their like their animations, right? You know, some of those subtle animations. For example, you delete something and you see a nice little animation, you know, drop something into the trash bin. And now Google is actually picking up on that, you know, with some of the work they're doing with material design, where they're really using a lot of rich set of animations to really bring the functionality and the OS alive. I think it's really exciting.
We've got a nice conversation going on in the chat room right now between Web4413 and Crisp P, and they're going back and forth on, well, should a button just be a button, or should there be some sort of reward? And actually, this is one of the questions I think design teams like yourself have really picked up. That sometimes, yes, you could have the software just do it for you, mm-hmm. but there is, as Lou alluded to, there's something about having an emotional response from the user that kind of draws them into the interface. And that's mm-hmm. not just mm-hmm. a game. That's not just, cute animation. You can actually make people more productive when they want to interact with the interface rather than they have to interact with the interface. How do you do that? How do you gauge that point? I mean, because you can go overboard. You can make it so that, you push the button and rainbows shoot out and now the screen spins around, and that's too much. But you could also make it so dull that people just think of it as, it's a gray box tool, and I turn it on and I do this and then I turn it off.
I think in the past, I think designers wanted to kind of model objects on the screen to real world objects. So that's why you see a lot of gradients and buttons and things like that. But I think and even Apple did that, right? For example, for some of the old bookshelf application, you would see like a bookshelf with the background and everything. But I think over time, people kind of start to realize, this is not the physical world, right? This is just a digital world. And so things don't necessarily have to look exactly the same. But I think what is happening is that there's a new movement coming out now called micro interactions. And I think what's happening is designers are looking for some of those small interactions that really just add a little bit of excitement to the software, right? For example, in some applications, you have to click into a bunch of different screens just to get something done. Now there's a new class of software that's essentially trying to say, hey, instead of doing that and letting the user having to click back and back and back, why not just bring all that functionality into one screen, into one little interaction? That makes the user's life a lot easier and simpler. So I think you're going to see a lot of this simplicity really in the industry coming to light.
Right.
So in your career, one of the things that you know that you found important, especially when you moved from Fargo to Seattle, and we talked about this, off camera too a lot, is the fact that you do a lot of networking. And so for you, what do you think, how do you think networking really impacts you, and how do you think it influences, kind of innovation and moving products forward and so on?
I tell you, man, I think networking is something that I wish I would have started earlier. And I think, I think part of it was just really just come to a bigger city like Seattle, where there was just, a lot going on, a lot of opportunities and a lot of different people doing different things. But personally, I think the biggest benefit I've gotten out of networking really is just a pure inspiration. When I look at some of the people I've encountered, some of these people are mentors to me. Some of these people are just really doing big things. I think for me, really, for the first time in my life, I kind of saw a much bigger world out there in terms of what I could do, in terms of I don't have to be just, I don't just have to be comfortable with my 9-to-5. I could run a business. I could run a multi-million-dollar business. So why am I being comfortable with the 6 figures when I could do bigger things? I think personally that's one of the best things I got out of networking.
Yeah, I think one of the things that networking it does too, and tell me what you think, is it kind of gets you jazzed up about something else. You're working on your daily job and you're working on your projects, but you get to see what everyone else is doing. Is that happened for you? What kind of other projects you've seen people do that kind of gets you jazzed up?
Oh man, I think for me, just networking is just pure inspiration. Also just kind of hearing other people's stories and their challenges, right? I think really kind of helps to put things into perspective. And I think another example is, for example, just talking to one of my friends owns the largest adult store on Android, on mobile in the world, right? But that sounds exciting until you hear the backstory of know, when he used to eat ramen noodles, right, and live with his brother and things like that. I think those are things that really make me realize that, wow, like, you know, I could do big things, but it's not going to be easy, right? There's going to be some hurdles. But eventually, if you really believe in your idea, right, and you put some effort towards it, it can really you know, be successful. So I think networking for me has not really been about the opportunity, but also about just being able to relate to other people so that when I run into similar situations, I can say, you know, this person went through it. Maybe I can handle it this way as well.
Hopefully Lou can push a little bit more on that helping other people into this environment, into this place of opportunity. But I'd love for you to back up a little bit, because again, the conversation's still going on in our chat room about what is too much. You know, when does it become intuitive and when does it become just a cutesy nightmare? You talked about this idea of micro interactions, taking input that might be spread over multiple screens and bringing it down into a single plane of glass, which we love. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. Mm-hmm. But can you give us an example of some of the cues that you use to know when you're at the right percentage? When are you there, and when is it either too simple or too complicated, too busy? Because that's also a temptation when you do the single pane of glass, which is to put everything on one sheet, and then now it's the opposite of being cutesy. It's now just too much.
And I think that's when research and design plays a very important role, right? There is a role called design researchers, and that's what they do, right? So the designers build these things, and we test them with users, right? So you also look at design testing. We test them with users. You do things like A/B testing to see, hey, does this work or does it not? Right? How do users kind of respond to this? So design is really hard. You know, design is really hard because what works for you may not work for another person, and so I think that is when it becomes absolutely critical to test your designs and to do research and usability research as well. But you're right. Sometimes it can be a little too much.
We've got another question from someone in the chat room, from Andy Germany. He's one of our listeners. Mm-hmm. And he makes an interesting point. He says, look, modern computers and modern internet speeds have changed a lot of things about design. You can do things now that you couldn't do 10 years, 20 years ago. And and that's part of the reason why we've seen what has changed in far as what is acceptable in your user interface.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that? And if you have seen that, where will we be in another 10 years? I mean, I know I'm asking you to stare into a crystal ball. And yeah, I'm asking you a question that if you answer correctly will earn you billions and billions of dollars. But you know, the technology will continue to develop, will continue to get faster connectivity, will continue to get faster computers with faster graphics parts. If the sky was the limit, what would be the ultimate interface?
Well, the good news is that, you know, that's another one of the things I do is I actually pay attention to the industry, right, to focus on industry trends and things like that. Now, I think in the next few years, some of the really big things you're going to see is the Internet of Things, right, where we're going to have all these smart devices in our homes. You're going to have your fridge communicating with your phone. You're going to have your bed even communicating with your mobile devices where, you know, essentially users don't have to do much. You'll be walking in the store, walking by the grocery section, and your fridge will alert you that, hey, you're running out of milk, right? These are some of the crazy things that are going to happen. Wearables are going to be big. I mean, hell, they're already big now. You know, but I think with all these Internet of Things and sensors and everything coming up, I think the next decade of technology really is going to be really exciting for sure.
So now let's shift a quick gear right here. So one thing you mentioned before is you started mentoring people. So what kind of motivates you to help other people kind of learn about technology and go get into technology?
You know, I think for me, just really helping people essentially, I think it's just my way of giving back. Right, because when I look at my life right now, man, and I think back to 15 years ago when I really had nothing, I think the fact that somebody gave me a shot and say, hey, I'm going to help you to go to the United States to go to school, right, to give you a chance at life, I think it would be absolutely terrible if I don't do that for another person, you know. And I think that also being the only child, man, I tell you, I just, you know, a lot of very good things that have happened to me have been through people, right, through strangers, through friends. And so essentially, man, you know, that's just my way of giving back. You know, I think that know, if God puts you in a certain situation of power or whatever, I think he expects you to kind of reach out a hand and hold up and help other people to kind of get them to a better place. So, you know, I think it's just my way of really just giving back.
So you mentioned, you know, that you do mentor people. What type of people do you mentor, and, you know, where are they at now? Like, what, can you give a specific example, a story?
Yeah. So I, you know, over the past couple of years, I kind of came across 6 or 7 different people that were really struggling in their jobs, right? Some of these people were not making enough money. Some of these guys were making like $10 an hour, $12 an hour. And what I was noticing in the tech industry is that I was starting to meet a lot of these people that had no communication, no computer side backgrounds, right? But some of these people were developers, testers, UX designers. And so I said, wow, like if these people with no like computer science degrees can actually, you know, learn and get jobs in the IT field, then I bet you a lot of people can do it. So I started training these people. I would meet them at night and weekends and train them. And, you know, out of these 7 people, man, these people went from making like $20,000 a year salaries to $80,000 a year, $90,000 a year, $100,000 a year. So I essentially kind of saw an opportunity where I said, hey, if you have the time and the passion and the desire to learn, you can get yourselves in some really good place. So I got 7 people right now. One is at Microsoft. One just finished. One also worked at Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks and Samsung and a few of the big name companies in Seattle. It's exciting, you know, it's exciting, man. And when I see them and I see where they were at and where they are now, you know, that's the beauty of life, man. That's the beauty of life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Noah Addy. He is the CEO and founder of Digital Fio. He's a design expert. And unexpectedly, he's not just telling us about what makes for good design, but he's also talking a little bit about the transformational power of computer science. Noah, when we come back, we've got some fun things we want to talk about. The chat room is starting to talk about the next generation of UX UI, specifically what happens once we move past the display. Are you game to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. I love that.
Let's do that. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the second sponsor of this episode of Coding 101, and it's DigitalOcean. Now, let me ask you something. When you have a project, when you have an app, when you have a service, when you have something that you want to release to the world, how do you go about getting it up? Well, if this was the old world, you'd have to contract space with a colo, probably buy a server or rent part of a server. Make sure you've got a maintenance contract. Oh, and don't worry about it. You have to handle the back-end security because that's your box and you have to take care of it. Yeah, you could do all that, but we don't do that anymore. And we don't do that because we've got companies like DigitalOcean. Specifically, we've got DigitalOcean giving us Droplets. Droplets are the easiest way to stand up your app or your service. Whatever it is that you need to have running quickly, efficiently, and securely, that's what DigitalOcean lets you do. Now, DigitalOcean is built for developers, and it's used by over 400,000 of them, including me. I use it to deploy droplets via a streamlined control panel. It's a simple API that lets me containerize, virtualize the services that I need and have them up and running on as small of a host as possible and scale them to as large as I need. That's one of the allures of DigitalOcean, which is if I'm doing a beta and I want to share it with 4 or 5 people who are just going to check out the service, or if I want to expand the beta and share it with a few thousand or a few 10,000s or a few hundreds of thousands of people, it's as simple as pressing a button. You get to choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. They've got a one-click install that lets you quickly deploy apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki, Node.js, WordPress, Ghost, Magento, OwnCloud, Ruby on Rails, and more. All their servers are built on hex core machines with dedicated ECC memory and RAID storage. And their servers can have up to 20 CPUs, 64 gigabytes of memory, and 640 gigabytes of SSD space. It's highly scalable to meet the demands of a rapidly growing application or business. And they've got auto backups and snapshots to take part of those pesky parts of administration that you'd rather not deal with. They also give you full-featured DNS management to easily manage your domains or, if you want, to use dedicated IPs. They've got web console access with HTML5 plus SSH, SFTP, KVM, VNC for virtual desktops. And one of my personal favorite features is an extremely active community. People who are using their service who can tell you their real-world solutions to problems that you might be having. And it's so easy to get started, you can deploy an SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing with servers starting at just $5 per month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so that you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. That's right, for nothing, for zero. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code C101 for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do for you. That's DigitalOcean.com, DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, enter the code C101 in the billing section to show some love for Coding 101 and to get yourself a $10 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Coding 101. Noah.
Hi.
Let's get futuristic. So one of the things that is big and becoming bigger, it doesn't seem to be going away. It's not a fad as it was 20 years ago and 30 years ago and however many times it's popped up. Moving beyond the screen, moving beyond just two dimensions. No matter how big the screen is, it's still just a screen. But now we've got 3D. Now we've got AR. Now we've got VR. And we've had some decent attempts from Google, from Microsoft. A few companies have given us interesting uses of our smartphones. But we need a new paradigm of design to make a user interface for a 3D VR AR model versus a 2D model. What do you see as some of the biggest differences?
I think when you look at, you know, what Facebook would do, is doing with the virtual reality, you know, and Google was doing with their Cardboard and Microsoft with HoloLens. I think one is going to offer a new set of challenges for designers, but I think the biggest opportunity for us is that it's going to usher in a new age of just really immersive experiences that we've never seen before, and I think that's a huge opportunity for, you know, for developers, for designers, for business people. And I think there's just going to be just so many just immersive and just rich experiences that, you know, a lot of people really haven't seen before.
Andy Germany and a few others in the chat room are picking up on things that we've said on the Twit TV network, which is the technology is interesting. It's very interesting. In fact, it's much better than what I remember from my childhood. My first virtual reality experience was with, do you remember the, or maybe you won't, The Virtual Boy. It was a Nintendo product that was supposed to be 3D, and all it did was give people headaches and seizures. It was fantastic.
Right.
It was
the red and blue. That's right. Yeah. Red and blue. Mm-hmm.
But they're also pointing out, like Andy Germany and Web4413 are pointing out, that we're kind of in the nascent stage. This is the Palm Pilot to the smartphone. We don't have quite the resolution that we need to have the full 360 immersive experience. Even something like Microsoft's HoloLens, which I really like. I love that approach. This idea of AR is so much more appealing to me than VR. But you've got tiny little slits of displays, and they've done a good job of making sure that the AR sticks to real-world objects. Mm-hmm. But until I don't have to worry about having a clunky set of glasses on or a big power pack strapped to my waist, it's not there yet.
Yes, you're right.
What do we need out of a user interface? Because even the ones that I've played with, it's still the whole idea of there's a screen here. Uh-huh. Part of me thinks that the proper paradigm is not to think of screens anymore, because we're no longer limited by a physical object. What would be your take?
You know, I think there's certain industries where that's going to be really applicable, right? Like education, like gaming. I think those industries can really benefit a lot from some of these 3D things. Even manufacturing, really, I think manufacturing definitely, I think is a good industry for that. But I think when it comes to the software side of things and productivity, I think it's going to be really interesting. You know, I saw some of the demos from Microsoft on the HoloLens, and when I see kind of what people are doing with it, it's actually really fascinating. You know, and some of this stuff is so new that, you know, I'm still, you know, personally, I'm still trying to kind of wrap my head around kind of what all the possibilities are. But for sure, man, I think there's a lot of exciting stuff that's brewing.
Yeah. Now, it's funny because now we've sparked another conversation in the chat room. You're doing a very good job at this, by the way. Chat room likes people who are bright, who are open to new ideas. We've got Creamy Corn Cob. We've got Lawn Dog talking about the Palm Pilot, about VR, about AR. Let me ask you this, and this is sort of a blanket question. This is not just VR or AR. Uh-huh. When you look around, what are some of the biggest mistakes you see in design? What do you look at an interface and say immediately, oh, that's ugly, or that, wow, that was wrong, that was so poorly designed? And typically, what are the red flags that tip you off to bad design?
I think when the user asks a question is like, what do I do here? Or like, where do I go? Or I can't find this menu that I was looking for, right? I think for me, that's the first red flag, right? I think that design should bring everything to the forefront. And I think because of mobile and some of these really small real estates, I think people are trying to hide a lot of things, right? If you look at a lot of mobile website, right, there's all this like off-canvas navigation and things like that. You know, people call them hamburger icons, right? And sometimes some of these icons are not intuitive. I remember I was trying to send an email. This was probably a few months ago, and I didn't know what the icon meant. I clicked it and the freaking message just disappeared. It did not look like a delete icon. I don't know what happened, but the freaking thing just disappeared. So I think it's just, I don't know, it's crazy.
So from your experience, maybe you can give some what we like to call nuggets of knowledge that you can offer to people who are, you know, just starting out to programming or, mm-hmm. you know, want to learn web technologies, want to even learn UX design. What kind of things mm-hmm. do you usually give out as recommendations?
You know, for me, there's a few websites that I've used, and I was actually really excited to see that lynda.com is one of the sponsors on the show. I actually do use lynda.com. I have a subscription there, and it's really helpful. Another site that I found really helpful, especially for learning the web stuff, was htmldog.com. It was also really helpful as well. And, you know, there's sites like pluralsight.net, and there's also, I think, W3 Schools. But I think personally, the best way that I learned was really just trying to do something hands-on. And I think one of the best advice I would really give to people is that find somebody that's really good at what you're trying to do and ask them questions. And I think one of the things that have been really helpful to me is that I've been able to reach out to different people, like in designers and things like that, that are always really, you know, really just ready to just give you feedback. One of the guys that actually played a really big role for me in my design career is a guy named Robin Barrow. He's the director for experience at GoDaddy, you know, and I think that when he saw that I was really trying to learn design, you know, he would always give me feedback about my work and things like that. And I think that really took me to just a whole nother level.
We've been speaking with Noah Addy. He is the CEO and founder of Digital Fio. I want to get this right because it's named after your mother, so it's
yes,
Fio,
yes.
Correct? Not Fio.
Yes. Well, my mom's name is Fio, you know, but the American version I say Fio, but Fio, same thing.
You go,
potato.
he is a design guru. He's the person who tells you how you should create your UI, how you should interact with your users. And I think I want to end on this. When you think of all the people who are entering CS, you can, of course, see the people who are going to be tending more towards CS. And mm-hmm. you start to see the people who maybe know CS but are heading towards design. But mm-hmm. there is sort of a holy grail here. And the holy grail is the CS person who actually understands design. And you don't mm-hmm. see a lot of them. They don't really exist in the wild. They typically go to one camp or another.
Yeah.
If you had a class of students in front of you, mm-hmm. what would be your advice to them as far as heading in one direction or another? Because as you said, both of them can be extremely lucrative. And I think if people understand that you don't have to be a hardcore coder to do programming, mm-hmm. or you don't have to be mm-hmm. a hardcore designer to do programming, mm-hmm. it makes mm-hmm. it easier for them to ease into it. What do you want to say to those young men and women?
I think the people that I've seen that are really very curious and trying to understand how things work, I think those actually end up being very good programmers. And then the other group of people that are very artistic, right? They dress very nice. They're very particular about what they wear and what colors and things like that. It's kind of weird, but those actually end up being very good designers.
Fantastic. Noah, I want to thank you for being part of this episode of Coding 101. It is always a pleasure to speak with people who aren't just good at what they do, but they have inspiring inspiring stories. And the fact that you were able to come over to the United States, you were able to get into a field that, by your own admission, you didn't know a whole lot about, and become one of the experts, one of the people who obviously Lou trusts and therefore I trust. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Could you please, we want to give you time to talk about whatever projects you may be working on. Could you tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find your company, and maybe where they can find your personal story?
Oh, thank you. Digitalfio.com is my website, and I'm very active on Twitter. So if you look for me on @UXNoah, I tweet a lot about a lot of different things I do. So follow me on Twitter and have some exciting stuff to share in the next few weeks.
And thank you for giving us that insight about Lou and Fargo, North Dakota. That was fantastic. Noah, again, I appreciate it. And hopefully we can have you back on another episode of Coding 101. Would you be open to that?
I would love that. Yeah, this is exciting. I would love that.
Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, Noah Addy. Of course, we also want to thank our super special co-host. We could not, literally, we could not have Coding 101 without him. He is the person in the field, the man who actually knows what he's talking about, Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, I know we've been having some camera problems, so hopefully you won't freeze during this, but could you please tell the folks where they can find you?
Absolutely. Well, you can always find me at LouMM on Twitter. And, of course, all my work that I do for CRM at Microsoft here is at crm.dynamics.com. So check us out. All, of course, according to 101 at 2:30 p.m. every Monday.
Thank you. Lou, Noah, thank you very much. Of course,
thank
also
you very much.
Thanks to you, the person who watches us each and every single week. We want to thank you. Without you, we couldn't have Coding 101. And so we want to give you something. We want to give you an easy way to get all of our episodes. This is important because if you want to catch up on the modules that we've covered, if you want to take a look at the wildcard episodes, the interviews that we've had, you can always go to twit.tv/coding. If you jump over there, you'll find our entire back catalog. So if you want to see what we said about PHP or when we did Ruby on Rails, if you want to see our last C# module, that's the best place to get it, including all the show notes that you need to find the links to download the packages that we've worked on. It's one of the things that we want to give you so that you can learn at your own pace. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you go there, you'll get to find out who we're going to be having on each show, what module we'll be covering. And, of course, I always give you hints about the projects that we will be having in the future of Coding 101. Finally, thanks to everyone here at the Twit Brick House who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo for letting us continue to do Coding 101. To my fantastic TD who today is Anthony. Anthony, do you have a camera on yourself? Could you say... There you go.
How's it going?
Could you tell the people what you do? Because you work in the background a lot, but you're a big part of Twit.
Yeah, a little bit of everything. Editing, TDing, graphics, a lot of graphics.
He's the man who actually made the graphics for Coding 101. So if you ever want to know where it came from, that's the man right there. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballasier. This has been Coding 101. And Lou Maresca, what do we say?
End of line.